here, Heather Scarf from Watari, and I said, I need to do this, and she said, you do what you need to do. And then, long story short of it, she was moved from one place to another. And there's just two of us there, and we recognized that there was four men. One was hiding in a vehicle. Everything is timing, but we managed to get her out of there. But we didn't realize that she, on her phone, they were tracking her. Thank God again, Summer Rain and Joanne. Everything was timing. Anyways, we managed to get her out. She was safe. She had to be moved twice, the last place. And then the calls were made back east. The SQ and the RCMP, they worked together with one of the speakers in the House, along with Senator Michelle Odette. We had her on that plane the following morning. I've never felt fear like that. I've been on the front line since 1986. Why I'm bringing this up, we need immediate action for a safe place to bring these young men, young girls, our children. Because if we didn't have the connections that we do here, she was already, they had already brainwashed her. There was a lot of hesitation. But again, thank God, and for Joanne that speaks fluent French, and at the Sahara with her contacts, we don't know what would have happened. So that is part of the 231 calls for justice and action here. We've been asking. I'm a family member. My mother was murdered down here. Three of my sisters were. I have a baby sister that was murdered in Merritt. And to this day, since my work, my goal in life was set to apprentice under world-renowned Bill Reed. That's where I was. That was my destiny right there. And my whole life changed. And I can honestly tell you, since I've been working down here at 86 on the front lines, nothing has changed. We still don't have any safe places for us to bring these young women. We've been asking for a health, healing, and wellness center. Yeah, the city's got all their blah, blah, blah. That's not what we're talking about. That may be great for at the inner city here, but what we're talking about is a health, healing, and wellness that would be, we would bring in our own elders, our spiritual people, land-based healing in that. That's what we're talking about. But to this day, we have got no safe place to bring them. We aren't even safe on the front lines anymore. It's a war zone down here. We've been doing the grid searches, again, up in Seminar. We weren't even there 5 minutes. We went up at the Curtis Sack Bones. To me, he is the copycat killer to Robert Willie Picton, but that does not even phase the RCMP. Again, with battered women's support, with Watari, we were able to go and do these grid searches. We don't have any money. We rely on one another to do this. We have no safe space, even up in that area, to bring our women. And when the families come into Vancouver or anywhere, we have no money to even set them up in hotels. I'm gonna bring it back to Kelsey Corman's father, living in his van, exhausted, tired, looking for his daughter. We have nothing to support the families when they come in. And we've been sitting at these tables for over 30 years saying the same thing, and it falls on deaf ears. Walk for Justice has over 6,000 women and young girls named nationally. and nothing is still done. We still don't have that support that is should be put in place for family members who shouldn't have to struggle, sleep in their vehicles, worry about when their next meal is going to be. They're exhausted out here. And, but you know, when those calls come in, like Grace Tate just sent us a thing of a young girl, 12 years old, we were gone. We leave everything. Thank God that I've got an amazing boss, Heather, who just, you go. There's no questions asked when that loved one. But again, at the end of it, that's one of the things I would really like to see immediately. We need those safe spaces to bring these loved ones before they become, you know, like a victim out there. Because I know, just being on these front lines, there is nothing. And we're saying the same thing over and over and over. But that's what I would like to really see immediately.
Hold on, Auntie. I just want to jump in a little bit of the story that Auntie was sharing. The challenge was not knowing who to call or getting a group of women together who were willing to respond late on a Saturday night or Sunday night, I believe it was. Friday night. That's right, because we were setting up the housing. So that wasn't a challenge. It was literally where to take this young girl to at that point in time. And so my only option at that point in time was to do a co-ed Indigenous youth shelter. Didn't understand her situation. She woke up in the morning to a very large male staff on shift, speaking in a language that she didn't understand at all. The concept of translation really didn't seem to happen for this young woman. And so, you know, that moment was a moment in which we could have lost this young girl because she felt more unsafe where she was than where she had been and had gotten to know for the last 2 months. So when my auntie says that we need somewhere to take our young girls and to take our women, we're not talking about permanently forever, but we're talking about in that moment at midnight on a Saturday night, where am I putting her that night to make sure that she is loved and that she is safe and that we can readjust and set a plan out in the morning. It's definitely a huge gap in what is currently out there, especially for our girls, because there is no girl-only housing available in the Lower Mainland or anywhere. Definitely the implementation of the 235 recommendations, I think we would all agree, needs to happen to have been implemented kind of with a bunch on the record saying that they've implemented them or that funding has been delivered to them, but that there's no result of that work or that money. And so investing in the frontline grassroots response is where it needs to go. And the thing that I dream about and would love to see is some form of unity between all of us, so that when our loved ones go missing, when our community is struggling with those searches, that we have a way to show up and be there for each other each time that happens, because it's always left to, like, you know, one of us at a time on this panel doing that work in isolation without the support, without the funding, without the resources. And so being able to come together and unite as Indigenous leaders on MMIWG to be able to respond and give that little bit of energy and life and power to that community each time one of our loved ones is missing. That's what I'm asking.
Thank you. Last spring, I believe, the federal government has Sandra Delarue. I had too much coffee today. Sorry, Sandra. It was announced that the province of BC and the province of Manitoba were getting red dress alert funding. And I went to go and see Sandra and Hilda Pierce to see what they were doing in Manitoba. And Sandra just urged me, just do it, just do it, just make it happen, just announce it, just get going with it, just do it now. I really would have loved to have done that, but the province is sitting on that funding. And they're doing all the research to see what the red dress alerts look like, all the alerts look like across the country. The minister at the time, Farnworth, had promised a silver alert, so an alert for elders Indigenous women are not organized, not a collective strong voice to say, let's get this done. We haven't harnessed our good allies to group and our ally organizations to help us, to ask them to help us, because let's face the reality, they have a stronger voice than we do. They care, and with their caring and with our caring to get things done, we can make it happen. But as long as we're letting the province, and that's really what's happening right now, sit on that funding and decide who qualifies the most and who's going to deliver the funding, it's just going to delay. So as Sandra said, nothing for us without us. Let's work and collect a plan and build a plan and make this happen. There's a commitment to build a red dress alert system here in Vancouver and one for up in the Highway of Tears. I'm not sure where we're at with that. Of course, we have the elections, where everything kind of stopped for 3 or 4 months, but we are the ones that need to hit the gas pedal on that and move it ahead.
Thank you. The next question I have for our panel here today is, what are your thoughts about implementing the red dress alert here in BC? What do you think would work? And what are your concerns?
I currently sit as an advisor with the City of Vancouver and with Rachel Watney and Elder Mary Point, Elder Cecilia Point, Mandy Mahady, Anita McPhee. The list goes on, and this is what we've been working on for the last 4 years. And it always feels, and you're right, it always feels like, you know, that there's always like a pushback. Well, we don't have money for this. Well, we need this, you know. And what I would like to see, and I agree with you, Leslie, is we need to pull this together ourselves, because we know, and I believe this is what you, as you also said, I'm really tired of sitting at these tables. I want action. I want to see it, because time is of an essence. Every time I sit at these tables, I think about how many more women are being violated, murdered, whatever, while we're sitting here and they're playing politics with our young women and girls and our families and that. As a family member, I'm really sick of this. I'm sick of not having those answers. We are the experts here. We are the ones on those front lines. The families know. And when I sit as a senior advisor to Senator Michelle Odette, there's two of us, Denise Pintu Maloney and myself. And this is one of the things that Senator Odette has really pushing for too. We're tired. We've listened to over 1,200 of the families at the National Inquiry, Highway of Tears, that the recommendations came out in 2006. At the symposium, at the first symposium, was in Prince George. And only 2 out of 33 recommendations were done. And that was because the chief in Witsette was the one that he mobilized it. And at the provincial government, right up to the very top dog, nothing. They haven't even looked at it since 2006. So we've got to do this ourselves. I know, I just turned 67, and I'm just like, I don't want to wait until I'm 80 or 90. I'll be around. I want something safe for my grandchildren and all your grandchildren, all of us. I think we're all on the same page, but I really believe that is that we have to do this ourselves, because it's not going to, they're not going to do it. And that's why we're doing the final walk to Ottawa, because we're done. We've had enough.
I want to take a page out of Laura Holland's book. Our dear friend Laura, many of us here know her. She's saying, defund the police. I think one of her demands was the always on body cameras. When we're talking about the red dress alert, I'm just concerned about the lack of police responsiveness, and they've demonstrated over and over and over again that they couldn't care less about what happens to our women and girls. And I think some of the initiatives that Indigenous communities have taken on, like the Drag the Red, I think those kinds of things need to be explored even further, rather than relying on the police to do anything for that matter. I think it's, we're better off to rely on community groups and to resource those community groups to do that job. We know the story of Chantal Moore when they were doing the wellness check and the police ended up killing her. And there have been so many police murders of our people, and it's becoming enough of a crisis that the chiefs are getting behind the campaign of addressing the police murders of Indigenous women. And the national chief of the Assembly of First Nations was on the media talking about that. So I think the red dress alert is a good idea, but I don't think that the police should play as significant a role as we think they should. I think that it should be more community groups, better resourcing, and better training for us to be able to find our own relations and to address issues of violence. They don't understand us anyway. All the training in the world that we do to try and bring about some level of understanding of our communities is, it's not working. They're never going to understand us. And the best chance we have of finding justice is through our own people in our community groups.
I would like to add a reflection as I'm listening to people that are here speaking, and it's around how the survivors and the families will gain access or gain autonomy and control over the information that is going to be collected with the red dress alert. How it's going to be managed. That means evidence that's being collected, testimony. What is the modus operandi that we're starting to see? Like, what are the trends that are happening that normally the authorities will not pay attention to because of what we already know. Either they're involved or they're just negligent and want to continue with that system of oppression of Indigenous women. So I think that it's really important from the get-go to make sure that the families and the survivors have access and control to that information, to those testimonies, to the evidence. Because the fact that the women are missing, they're missing in our community, they're missing in our families, they're missing in our society, and they continue to become missing or disappeared or erased in many ways. And I think that's the main goal. The women that are missing, and or they didn't just poof go missing, right? Somebody abducted them. There was a whole series of human rights violations that happened. That it's not just the person poof they disappeared, but they went missing. So I think that only the families and the communities know firsthand that experience. Know firsthand, this spark of detail in the story, that's connected to another woman that is missing or another girl, right? That's why it's so important. Whenever one of these women is found, all the others are being found. So I think that that's something that we really need to make sure how the families and the survivors will have access to that information. Will have access and control over those testimonies and decide what to do with that or not. Not just in the present moment, but for the future generations. In Guatemala, we created the organizations of sons and daughters of the disappeared. We were a different generation. It wasn't the mothers of the missing, right? Like, because we grew up with our grandmothers and grandfathers, because there was a whole generation missing. And so, it was really, really surprising to us that 10, 15 years later, there was another organization called ORN that was called Nietes, which means grandchildren. So now they're the ones looking for the grandparents. And all the information that maybe verbally and orally was passed down, was documented somehow, right? We made sure to try to access certain technologies to pass down certain testimonies, certain evidence and stories, because at one point we realized that in this struggle and in this road to ending that impunity and discrimination and racism, that we had to recognize when our grandparents and grandmothers started passing away that although they had started that struggle and that fight, they had already passed away and hadn't seen the end of it. And our generation might go along that same way, and that's okay. It's hard to accept, but it's part of that reality. That even though we're in this struggle, and we are 100% and 1,000%, right? We drop everything to go and support someone. We might not be the ones to see it be finished and completed and come to fruition through that world of justice for women and girls, especially Indigenous communities. But it's our responsibility to contribute to that, thinking, okay, well, it's going to be the grandkids or that other generation that's going to complete this work. So this is why it's so important to make sure that from this point forward, we're able to recover those stories, those testimonies, evidence, anything possible. And the other element that I want to add is around how we are going to protect the women that are searching, las buscadoras. So the women that are searching are human rights defenders, and we have to treat them as that. And we have to protect them as that and demand that the authorities protect these women who are doing the searches as human rights defenders. Because although they might be looking for one particular auntie or a sister, yes, they are family members or survivors of that violence, but they're contributing to the broader community, right? To not just in their community, but we can, something that we can progress on or make advances in BC will contribute to something else, that is another case, let's say, or another search that is happening in Manitoba or further east, like anywhere, right? And across borders, as well as my some of the women here are also seeing. Thank you.
I think I will answer both of your questions. I have a few things to say. I just want to say I agree with what was said about people who are human trafficked. There is absolutely nowhere safe for them to go. These guys have connections all over, so it's not like they can just go to a shelter. People in the community are there. People talk, and sometimes it gets back to the traffickers. I supported a woman recently where she was here, but her family came to find her from Alberta, but he had connections, so we were worried he was gonna follow her back or have people go after her when she was making her way back to Alberta. And when it comes to trafficking, I actually started my bachelor's degree in tourism and business management a long time ago before I started to do my advocacy work. Unfortunately, my brother passed away and then I became pregnant. And so I stopped going to school for a while. And I decided to go back during COVID because it was being offered online. And when I went back, I thought there was nothing there for me. In tourism and business management, I thought, I don't know why, I'll just get this out of the way. But then I realized, wait a second, there's trafficking all over the tourism industry. And all of my papers and all of my everything's focused on that. Even the simple field trip of spending the night in the hotel to write them up. People were talking about, there was a hair on the bed, there was a dirty glass, and I was going up to the staff and asking them what their policy is around human trafficking. And so I kind of got to know it really well because I got to interview police officers and all of that for my papers. And it's bad. I have more human trafficking cases now as opposed to before. I don't know if it's just my calling now or if this is what's, if there's more of it or all of the above. For the, along with this, immediate actions to respond to MMIWG is, I feel like, or from what, from my experience, we need to lawyer up right away, right off the bat. I went to go, at the beginning of my journey, we went to go see the police about my missing aunt's case. And I wish I had at least somebody from the community to support my family and myself, or a lawyer, because when you go back to the police with questions, like, you can't think of it right there in that moment because you're so emotional. And that's where somebody from the community or a lawyer would chime in. And what I've come across all these years that I've been doing this, which is not as much as some of these people here at the table, I'm just a baby at this, actually. But I just wish we had a lawyer, because they like to lie. They like to change their stories. And it's still happening to this day. You know, I worked closely with Natasha Harrison. Her daughter, Tatiana Harrison, was found recently on a dry boat dock. And it was from her that I learned you can actually record at certain meetings. You can actually write down and video. She videotaped everything. And this is how we were able to catch the police, the coroners, and everybody in the system in their lives. So not just for missing, but murdered families as well. And they do this in Mexico. This is where I learned about this in Mexico, is in Mexico, when a woman is found deceased, they automatically treat it as a homicide until they can prove that it's not. This should be done here, because a lot of our Indigenous women and girls' cases get swept under the rug as a drug overdose or something like that. It is, but I'll say, for example, again, Natasha Harrison's daughter's case. If you walked into where she was found, I would automatically think something was wrong. And I say that she gives me permission to say these things because she's fighting for her daughter. She's fighting so hard to this day, so hard where she hasn't even taken her daughter's body back to bury it. And it's been over 2 years now, because she does not want to rebury her daughter or unbury her daughter. She just wants a proper investigation in her daughter's case. I have more to say, but I'm aware of the time. I'll just leave it.
Are you passionate about skiing and looking for a way to give back this season? Join Canadian Adaptive Snow Sports and help us make a real impact by volunteering your time. From teaching adaptive skiing or snowboarding techniques to supporting our events, there's a role for everyone. Visit our website at www.cads.ski to learn more, volunteer, or make a donation.
Something curious, something cultural, something unserious, sometimes serious, something mundane, something everyday, though not even really that. Tune into Typically Tuesdays, airing every Monday, you heard that right, Monday, from 3 to 4 p.m., your hour of quasi-cerebral talk and tunes.
Listen to music and podcasts from CGSF 90.1 FM with our radio app. It's on-the-go listening made easy. You can tune into all our music, spoken word, and multicultural shows using your device. Our app lets you set reminders so you'll never miss your favorite show again. Stay connected to CGSF 90.1 FM through our community radio app. Download the app from the Apple Store or get it on Google Play.